Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
Have you ever wondered how a book becomes a movie?
Or how a movie becomes a musical?
Or how anything is adapted at all?
Join us as we talk about your favorite stories and all the changes that were made along the way.
But more importantly, why? This is Willing to Adapt.
Hi, welcome back to Willing to Adapt. I'm Romy Reyes.
And I'm Eric Von Crumley.
And welcome back to our next episode.
Willing to Adapt. You're so awkward.
I know. I decided to try the opening this time.
It didn't work.
No, it didn't. I'll let you continue to do it.
All right. So I'll let you explain what we read and watched this time around.
Well, this time around, we watched and read Much Ado About Nothing by William Shakespeare.
Yes. Shakespeare.
Yes. I like Shakespeare. I know it's not everyone's cup of tea, but I think it's...
Yeah, I get it. I mean, I love Shakespeare too, but I get it. He can be difficult to get through at times. You really have to pay attention.
And I think it's funny because I mentioned to someone, a coworker, that we were reading Shakespeare, and she's like, oh, I probably can't listen to your podcast. She's like, unfortunately, I've been ruined by TikTok.
What?
Her attention span. She's like, unless it's in like 10-second bites or 30-second bites, it's too much.
You know, I disagree with that. I think that's frustrating because that's like saying, oh, I can't go and work out because I've
oh,
just...
no. It is a cop-out. I mean, it's not, you know, they...
Like, you can strengthen it. You I think can people get have better. You can have a better attention span.
Yeah, no, I agree. And like, actually, every time I read Shakespeare, I'm not... This is not an advertisement, but I read the Folger edition. And I like that one.
Brought to you by Folger.
Not coffee, because on the left side they give you the interpretations of words that are no longer either used or that are used differently today.
Yeah, I found this sounds so nerdy. I recently found a Shakespeare lexicon at the thrift store.
I know there was one I've been wanting to get. I'd love to see it. You didn't bring it with you today, did you?
What was that?
Did you bring it with you?
Not today.
Oh, I'd love to see it because there was one I've been wanting to get for like years.
Well, it's only the first volume of two. It didn't have the other ones. So.
Okay. Because it started as an online website.
Did it?
That, I'm not sure if this is it, but there was one where it was a lexicon. It was a fan of Shakespeare. They started just doing it on their own, and it got so popular that they were hired to put together an actual
book.
Yeah.
It's like the nerdiest thing
I can
think of. Good for them. I hope they got paid.
Yeah. No, they did.
Great. Okay, so when were you first, man, like a child, when were you first exposed to William Shakespeare?
So I think like most people, my first exposure to Shakespeare was definitely through Romeo and Juliet.
What is that?
It's probably the one thing that, well, the one Shakespeare play that almost everyone knows.
At least knows the basic plot.
Yes, because it's...
They all die at the end.
Pretty much. And plus, there's so many adaptations of that one.
It's true. The Leonardo DiCaprio one's probably the most popular.
Which I've never seen.
Well, you see, we're going to talk about this at some point. This will be a special episode.
But
don't worry, folks. It won't be anytime soon. We're going to space these out.
Yes.
I mean, to be fair, I think we already have a wide range.
We do. Actually, kind of before I move on when I saw it, one of the articles when I was researching, I came across, it was like the top 30 adaptations of Shakespeare. And there were some of them that I'd never thought of as adaptations.
Like what?
The Lion King.
Yeah, it's Hamlet.
I didn't realize that. I was like, I got it.
And you say you're a Shakespeare fan.
I just read Hamlet for the first time this year.
To be fair, it's like inspired by Hamlet. Yes, it's not really an adaptation.
But back to when I first was exposed, I vaguely remember... I want to say it was on TV and watching bits and pieces of it when I was a kid. I don't know if that's true or not, or if that's something I just think I remember.
Probably on PBS.
Maybe. Because I want to say...
PBS like Masterpiece.
My mom and dad were watching it, or my mom. I don't think my dad was watching it. And I happened to walk in, saw pieces of it, got bored. So really the first time I read a Shakespeare play was definitely high school. It was English Lit. Which would have been my senior year. No, we would have read Romeo and Juliet earlier than that. So I read Romeo and Juliet
my freshman year, so.
Then that's probably when I read it as well. I'm trying to remember timelines.
I just remember reading it in class, already knowing the play, and thinking, can I just test out of this?
Yeah, no, I by that point, I mean, I knew all about it, enough of it. I remember watching the old movie.
Oh, from the 60s?
Yeah.
Oh, man, I have a funny story about that one.
Do you?
Yes. So in that one, there's the scene after they get married and they spend the night together.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, mind you, we're like 14, right?
Yeah.
All of us were sitting there watching, and the girls are all freaking out because the guy's butt is shown at one point, and they're like, ooh. But all the guys are sitting there because the girl who plays Juliet, like, her blanket is slowly creeping down her chest,
mm-hmm.
and the guys are all like leaning forward going and then she would pull it up, and then it wouldn't show anything, and we're like and then it would keep happening like consistently in the scene. It's like and then eventually when they find out that he needs to take off or else they'll be found because her parents are coming,
yeah,
she like throws the blanket off and she's like bare-chested, and all the guys in the class go yeah.
I don't think my class cheered, but I know that I know it was...
I felt bad for my teacher.
It was one of the favorite scenes. Yeah, no, I but even though I was exposed and I knew a lot about Shakespeare because of freshman year, I want to say I really felt like I didn't get to know fully more about him until we read Macbeth our senior year.
Okay.
Yeah, because then I was exposed to something beyond just the one that everyone knows.
Right,
know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then when was the first time that you read or watched a version of this, Much Ado About Nothing?
Oh, this time. This
was my really? First
time. Yeah, I've
You've
actually...
never seen it or read it.
No, it has not. But no, I think most of these things are books that I've wanted to read or that have been on my list, but I haven't gotten around to.
I'm not going to lie. Shakespeare is one of those things that I like the idea of Shakespeare a lot more than actually listening to it. I love Shakespeare, don't get me wrong, I do love mm-hmm. Shakespeare, but I love the idea that I love Shakespeare more than actually loving Shakespeare.
Okay,
does that make sense?
No, it does, because it is hard to get through when you're trying to understand it versus yeah. just doing a cursory read.
Yeah, I really want to be, like, in all intents and purposes, an academic,
mm-hmm.
but then actually practically doing it, sometimes I'm like, I'm just so lazy.
Yeah, no, because like in reading this, I read it twice.
Good.
So the first time I read it as Shakespeare wrote it, or at least according to how they've put it in this book, and then the second time I read it with
you
the
read
trends.
Like the modern English.
Well, no, I would take the stuff on the is this right left this is the left side I take stuff on the left hand side.
For all the listeners who did not just watch what just happened, Romy had to put his fingers up in the L shape to figure out which was left.
That is another conversation. All I can tell you is, you want to know my why I have to do that, watch Sherlock and his theory of mind, and that will explain the importance of left and right to me. Anyway, yeah. So what I would do is I would then
how does that affect your driving?
Oh, it's funny. I had this conversation with someone recently. It doesn't really that much, because I know left is the long way, right is the short way. But if I'm somewhere else, well, then that's a whole other story.
Okay, Dr. Seuss.
So... But then I would take the translations and then read it with the translation.
Nice. I love the translations that are like clearly supposed to be modern. So like in, I think one time somebody jokingly was doing a modern version of Romeo and Juliet. And mm-hmm. it was like, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou Romeo? Deny thy father and refuse thy name. Mm-hmm. And they're like, Romeo, boy, why are you Romeo? Like, give up that name. You know, I was like, this is weird.
Yeah, no, I don't.
It's like Romeo and Juliet on the streets.
When we come to an adaptation like that, we'll discuss that. I don't know what I think about that. It's different to me when I'm translating it to understand what they're talking about,
mm-hmm.
versus it's kind of like when I had a discussion with someone recently about reading the Bible in King James. And we were talking about accuracy and translations and things like that. But I was telling them that I grew up with the King James. And to me, the beauty of the Bible in King James surpasses modern translations. And if I really am in doing a Bible study, then I'll get a modern version, or I'll look at the Greek and Hebrew to kind of figure out what is really being said. But for the most part, sometimes when I'm reading the Bible, I want to read it for artistic purposes as well.
It's always tough, though, because translations... You know, it's always written for an original language, and so some things get lost along the way, and so it's really good to go back and take a look at, like if in your case, when we're talking about the Bible, you know, in the Old Testament it's Hebrew, in the New Testament it's Greek.
Yeah.
So, and again, our Bible study, we jokingly still call it this. There was a study we were going through, and it would always have a section called Peek at the Greek.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a good one for Hebrew. We couldn't come up with a good rhyme for that one.
Yeah, I don't know what that would be.
In my case, I think Shakespeare's always kind of just been on my conscience, not conscience, in my, around my atmosphere, I guess. You know, I can't really think of a time where I didn't really know about Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
My parents were weird. They really exposed me to a lot of things.
Yeah.
A very wide range of things, which I appreciate because I feel like they wanted us to be well-rounded.
Mm-hmm.
But I also feel like I grew up in a very cultured, immediate family household.
Okay.
I grew up with in a very big family because it was my grandparents' mm-hmm. house. And so it was like 12 of us at one point because it was my cousins and their family.
Mm.
Yeah. But we got along fine. It was good. And then I think it really taught me how to interact with people that think differently than you,
mm-hmm.
which I appreciate, especially in today's society.
Differently than me? Or no, I'm just kidding.
Anyways. But no, I think the first time I heard about Much Ado About Nothing actually was from my parents.
Mm.
Because we haven't mentioned that we're talking about Kenneth Branagh's 1993 film version of Much Ado About Nothing.
Correct.
But that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, not the 2012 version?
No, there's a few different versions, yeah. My parents love the 1993 version. It's one of those things that I didn't know they loved it until I was probably, like, in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were just watching it randomly one day, and I'm like, are you guys watching Shakespeare? And they're like, yeah, we love this one. I'm like, since when? I've never seen you watch this.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it came out the year I was born. That's exciting.
You were born in 93?
We've talked about this.
I know. I don't remember.
I've given my age. You have not.
That's right. I did. I was listening to our first episode.
I keep trying to get you to say your age on the podcast, and you have not said it yet.
One day.
We've circled the drain. I know you've been in high school. You were in high school in the mid, late 90s, I think.
I graduated in the mid 90s, if I remember right.
Yep. There you go. I'm circling the drain.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways. But no, I love this one. It's a good one. It's I always love his comedies. His tragedies are great too, but I love his comedies. They're very witty.
I think this is the first comedy then I've read. Because if I've read Hamlet, Macbeth, Romeo and Juliet, Julius Caesar, and not Much Ado About Anything. I think I saw one in a movie. Is Taming of the Shrew a comedy?
Yes.
Okay. I had to watch that in a class, but I think we watched it in Spanish class or something. I don't remember why.
That's weird.
I know, in high school.
They just ran out of things to do.
They probably did. And I remember vaguely watching it, but I was so tired, I didn't really pay attention. I think I slept.
I think for this episode, there's actually not a whole lot we have to talk about. But at the same time, if we really wanted to, this could get very academic. And so we're going to try and make a balance there. But so did you enjoy this? Did you enjoy the...
I did. I really enjoyed the... So I read it first and then watched the movie.
You see, that's out of character for you.
Yeah, no.
Because I usually will read the source material first and then watch the adaptations in order, mm-hmm. chronologically. But you... I remember the Pride and Prejudice episode. You started with the Keira Knightley version. You then watched the BBC version. And yes. Then you read the book. But not only that, you like started the book like halfway through an adaptation.
Yes. And so this
you
one,
just I live for chaos.
I do. I'm not very ordered. And this one, I went back and reread it afterwards with the translations on the other side. So I inserted the translations into the into my reading, so this way I could kind of better understand what they were joking about and things like that. I did find so in the reading of the first time, it made sense and I liked it, but watching it on screen added a lot, and I found that I was chuckling with some of the jokes
mm-hmm.
as they were saying them because I had already read them and kind of knew what they were talking about.
Shakespeare, kind of like when we talked about Jane Austen, he's great because he reminds me of Shrek. You know, Shrek has layers, onions have layers, Shakespeare has layers.
Yeah.
And so every viewing, every reading, you always get more out of it. Mm-hmm. You always find more jokes, you always find more deeper motifs and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. I did read one essay afterwards, though, that I felt like they were just pulling things out of their backside to sound educated. But for the most part, I felt it was very... I felt they were going too deep on this one. I felt it's a comedy. You didn't have to go that deep to...
Oh, I definitely... Oh, I think I read the same thing.
Did you?
Probably. It sounded like someone's dissertation.
Yes. It felt like that.
Speaking of trying to sound more educated than you are, I am going to be straightforward and say that almost all of the analysis that I have comes from Cliff Notes and Spark Notes and Wikipedia.
That's funny. I almost read Spark Notes and then got bored.
So I'm going to briefly talk about Shakespeare. Okay?
Go ahead.
All right. William Shakespeare, this is from, I think, Cliff Notes. The most influential writer in all of English literature, William Shakespeare was born in 1564 to a successful middle-class glove maker, I did not know that, in Stratford-upon-Avon, England. Stratford-upon-Avon, England. Shakespeare attended grammar school, but his formal education proceeded no further. In 1582, he married an older woman, Anne Hathaway, not the actress, and had three children with her. Around 1590, he left his family behind and traveled to London to work as an actor and playwright. Public and critical acclaim quickly followed, and Shakespeare eventually became the most popular playwright in England and part owner of the Globe Theatre. His career bridged the reigns of Elizabeth I and James I, and he was a favorite of both monarchs. Indeed, James granted Shakespeare's company the greatest possible compliment by bestowing upon its members the title of King's Men. Wealthy and renowned, Shakespeare retired to Stratford and died in 1616 at the age of 52. His works were collected and printed in various editions in the century following his death, and by the early 18th century, his reputation as the greatest poet ever to write in English was well established. A number of Shakespeare's plays seem to have transcended even the category of brilliance, becoming so influential as to affect profoundly the course of Western literature and culture ever after. And I think one of the things that I love about Shakespeare is knowing and finding out how many words that we speak today that he just made up.
Yeah, I read that somewhere too.
I mean, I knew that ahead of time. It's just it's just funny. There's so many that you would never think of that he just made up for his plays.
Mm-hmm.
All right, yeah. So, Shakespeare.
And there was I remember reading that not everybody agrees that he went to grammar school.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I thought you were going to say that not everybody agrees that he wrote all his plays.
Oh, no, we're not going to go down that route.
I was like, we agreed on this.
Yes. He wrote them according to us and the scholars we believe and read.
Well, but I think everybody of an academic standpoint has said there really is no evidence that he did not write mm-hmm. them. And
yeah.
So you just kind of have to believe he did.
The circumstantial evidence is that he did it.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, some of the stuff we were talking about. But no, it's...
But hey, if you're into, you know, conspiracy theories.
Yeah. It's pretty much
dive down that one.
Mm-hmm. No, but one of the things I thought was interesting is how... Because I was looking for a biography on Shakespeare. And
just one?
Well, it turns out that nobody really knows anything about him. So there are biographies. But a lot of it's conjecture.
Sure.
And that a lot of the early biographies are filled with, what do you call those? Like made up anecdotes, basically.
Yeah, it's tough because, you know, this is right around the time with like the printing press coming out. And,
mm-hmm.
and so it's definitely more prolific to have books and things than it used to be. But not everything was documented the way that it is now, especially in our modern culture.
Oh, definitely.
But, you know, most people back then, you only really kept track of people of high standing.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else kind of just, you know, lived their lives.
And he was important enough to be remembered. Which
oh, of course.
Is, I mean, a huge thing, you
yeah.
know, for that era.
And but, I always love to find these stories of people who were popular when they were alive.
Yeah. No, but I remember the one of the things that they were, some of the writings were debating were whether or not he went to grammar school. But most say that when you look at the extensive allusions or other things that he not just wrote about directly, but that he puts into the dialogue, that these are things you would have learned in. And their grammar school was kind of along the lines of ours. He would have been in school up until about, what, 12, 13 or so, 14, I think.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then he would have been an adult and then, by their standards.
And I think it might have been 12. But anyway, the higher, the second half of grammar school is when you would have gotten your Latin and a lot of the older literature classics and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I thought that was interesting.
This is also a time when people were looking back on the older times, like Greco-Roman history and culture and influences. And so you can find those sprinkled throughout his works.
Yeah.
Because it was very popular for his time to consider. I mean, obviously Christianity was prevalent in London, England. But at the same time, because it was the Renaissance, there was this look back into these other cultures. And so it was definitely within their society. And you can find references to different gods and mythology and things. It's very poetic.
Yeah. And I know that a lot of what I think people think they know about Shakespeare is, at least according to the articles I've read and things like that, is inaccurate. Especially if all you've ever seen is him portrayed in a movie. Like, did they make a movie about him?
Shakespeare in Love.
Is that what it is? Yeah, I know that's not...
It's definitely not accurate.
Accurate at all. Yeah.
It's basically just a romance.
Is that what it is?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's entertaining, but yeah.
In fact, I think the Doctor Who episode is more accurate than...
The one with the witches?
Yeah.
I think there's a couple, but still.
I read somewhere that was more accurate than Shakespeare in Love.
I just love to watch all the parodies of Shakespeare. One of my favorites, because there was a TV show I want to watch, but I think it's on BBC where they're making fun of Shakespeare as if... it's supposed to be like if he was alive in the actual time period and people like who worked with him. It's one of my favorites is people would go up to him. I've seen clips and they'll say something and he'll just respond and they're like, wait, what did you say? And he's like, oh, you know, this, I just made it up. Don't you like it? Things like that. All right. So should we talk about Much Ado About Nothing? I have some, this is much shorter for the background on Much Ado About Nothing. If you want to hear about that,
go ahead.
Okay, so Much Ado About Nothing is generally considered one of Shakespeare's best comedies because it combines elements of robust hilarity with more serious meditations on honor, shame, and court politics. It was probably written in 1598 and 1599 as Shakespeare was approaching the middle of his career. Like As You Like It and Twelfth Night, Much Ado About Nothing, though interspersed with darker concerns, is a joyful comedy that ends with multiple marriages and no deaths.
True.
Yay.
It was the first
one. It was
just
a metaphorical death.
Yes, yes. Compared to the other ones I've read of his, it was very different. I had some... It took me a little while, because since I watched... In watching it especially... Well, first off, we'll get to that. The actors who... We're in it.
Yeah, we're not talking about the movie yet.
No, but just kind of getting a sense for what the characters, how they're portrayed. Like, I'll be honest, the actors portrayed it very differently than I saw it in my head the first time around.
In the movie?
Yeah. So, okay. So when I was reading it, I think I read it very theatrically, but in the sense of just seeing a stage in my head and kind of how they might have done it and things like that. Yeah.
If you remember in our Pygmalion, My Fair Lady episode, I talked a lot about Jay Draper in her video.
Yes, I remember that.
So she has a video where she talks about how there is no way we could do Shakespeare today the way that it was done. It's another great video. I recommend it. Everybody should go watch it. She's just entertaining and it's very well done. But she talks about how when Shakespeare was first around, he was writing in a way that you actually didn't have to watch the action. And to be fair, in some of the places in the theater, you couldn't really see all the action. And she was saying that the way that he wrote his scripts, he wrote so that you didn't have to watch it. Like, you could just listen, and you would get all the things you need to know.
Yeah.
And this is most obvious when you listen to it and you're aware of this. In scenes where, like, a character enters or leaves, or when someone does something to someone, characters are always remarking on it. So you'll always hear a character say, in modern English, basically be like, oh, here comes my lady to beat you or something, you know? And then the character be walking on stage. Or somebody would say, somebody would like be hitting someone and they said, oh, look how she hits him or something like that. Like, they're constantly telling the audience what's happening in case they didn't see it.
That's interesting. I do know, I did read that that there was a lot of room for not interpretation, but for stagecraft. And that's why the stage directions were often minimal. They didn't say it was because of they didn't have a lot, but I think it was Romeo and Juliet when I read that one recently, because I read it a couple years ago. Oh, and when my daughter had to read it for high school, I read it with her. They were talking about how they brought some of that up, about how they wouldn't have had all the modern stuff we have today in the theater. And so their balcony scene might have actually have been where some of the audience was sitting, kind of next to them or something like that.
I mean, they had a balcony on the stage, but that was usually where, like, really high-end, like, aristocratic people would sit, because mm-hmm. then everybody in the house would see them.
Yeah. So have you ever seen pictures of the, like, replicas of the globe?
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. I actually went to the replica of the globe in London.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
I didn't watch anything there, but I did go.
Yeah.
I wanted to see something, but by the time I remembered it was there and we were in front of it, I was like, oh, this sold out. I can't see anything. Got it. Mm. I was a little bummed. I'll have to go back if I ever can.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
But no, it was very different. And I think one of the things people don't think about is they didn't rehearse the way that we rehearse plays now. They didn't have like a month to practice. They sometimes barely had like a week. And sometimes they got scripts like really short notice. And they were usually practicing and doing other plays at the same time.
Hmm.
And so it was so on the fly
yeah.
that it's remarkable that they were able to, you know, get it all in. But the other thing is because they didn't have the same rights to mm-hmm. the plays that we do now.
Yeah.
The playwrights like Shakespeare wouldn't give and also because he had to write it all, mm-hmm. he wouldn't give each cast member a complete script. He only gave them what they needed.
I did read about plagiarism, how it was really big. Like, people would actually sit in plays and write them out as they were going on, and then they would make illegal copies of them to further. Yeah. That's to me, that was weird. That was funny. It was interesting to know plagiarism, how long it's existed.
But they were saying that because of this, they didn't get the whole script, and because they didn't have a lot of rehearsal,
mm-hmm.
sometimes the actors themselves didn't actually know what was going to happen in the plot.
That's interesting.
And so they would know their lines, and they knew they needed to react to something, but they may not know exactly what they were reacting to.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you went to like a first showing of something, mm-hmm. you might be seeing genuine reactions from the actors.
Huh. Wow. That does make sense, though.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's a lot. I would recommend that video. It's great. There's so much more that I can't even remember and go into. But how about I give a very... I have a synopsis, unless you have a synopsis ready. But I have a synopsis for the play. Do you want me to read it?
Go ahead. I left mine in my bag.
Great. So in Act 1 of Much Ado About Nothing, it begins in Messina, where Leonato lives with his daughter Hero and her cousin and companion, the Lady Beatrice. Leonato receives word that his friend the Duke, Don Pedro, has returned from war and plans to visit with some of his fellow soldiers. Among the party is Claudio, who quickly falls in love with Hero. Benedick, a bachelor who has sworn off love and marriage, also comes, and he enjoys speaking his mind in witty argument with Beatrice. Act 2. Leonato holds a masked ball to celebrate the end of the war. While at the ball, the engagement of Claudio and Hero is arranged. At the same time, Don Pedro's brother, Don John, seeks a way to spoil the general happiness. Don John plots with the soldiers, Baraccio and Conrad, to deceive Claudio into believing Hero has cheated on him. Act 3. Hero, Claudius, and Don Pedro decide Benedick and Beatrice are ideal partners, despite or because of their bickering. They make a plot to allow Benedick to overhear them discussing Beatrice's love for him and vice versa. After a series of overheard conversations, Benedick and Beatrice realize they do indeed love one another. That night, Hero's maid Margaret talks with Baraccio from Hero's bedroom window. Claudio and the Duke watch secretly from a distance and think that the girl at the window is Hero. Act 4. At Hero's wedding, Claudio is still deceived into thinking Hero cheated on him. He denounces her, leaving her disgraced and apparently dead from shock. With the help of the priest, Leonato, Beatrice, and Benedict decide to pretend that Hero is actually dead until her name can be cleared. Later, the watchmen, managed by the bumbling village constable Dogberry, overhear Baraccio and Conrad brag about the trick that they played on Claudio and Don Pedro. They arrest the pair. Act 5. Dogberry's incriminating information is, after some difficulty, given to Leonato and Don Pedro. As penance for causing Hero's death, Claudio agrees to accept Leonato's niece, quote-unquote, in her place. The niece turns out to be Hero, conveniently. The play comes to a joyful conclusion as the lovers are reunited and Benedict and Beatrice announce that they will share the wedding day. Don John has been captured while trying to escape and is left for future trial while the play ends with a merry dance.
Very succinct.
Thank you. There's a lot to talk about.
Really? I thought you just finished it.
Well, I think I read that one for sure because there I knew if I tried to say it off the top of my head, I was going to forget things.
Yeah. So we're talking about the book first.
Yes. Yes, right. We should.
What's the first thing for you? Topic.
Oh, I have a lot more to read. Do you want to say something before I go back into what I've written down?
Oh, this is okay. So this is not synopsis or anything.
Oh, no,
like
I'm done with the synopsis. This is like analysis now.
Okay, go ahead.
You sure?
Yeah.
Okay. So, from Spark Notes, because I have no shame. The play relies on tensions created by a paradoxical use of deception by its characters. Deceit can be used as an instrument with which both to disrupt love between people and to encourage and promote it. Truth and reality, the play seems to suggest, have little value when it comes to love's pursuits. Much Ado About Nothing shows that deceit is not inherently evil, but something that can be used as a means to good or bad ends. And in regards to this, you know, characters are constantly pretending to be others or mistaken for others. Margaret's mistaken for Hero, leading to Hero's disgrace. During a masked ball in which everyone must wear a mask, Beatrice rants about Benedict to a masked man who is actually Benedict, but she acts unaware of this. During the same celebration, Don Pedro pretends to be Claudio and courts Hero for him. After Hero is proclaimed dead, Leonato orders Claudio to marry his quote-unquote niece, who is actually Hero.
Sorry. I zoned out.
Great.
No, it's very formulaic because I'm thinking in my head, it's like a lot of what I read and in regards to the analysis, but I don't know. Is it just me or are they really pulling a lot out of something that was probably just written as a comedy?
Wait, are you saying this is Much Ado About Nothing?
Pretty much. Yes. Because, like, it makes sense, but, I mean, was Shakespeare really thinking along those lines as he was writing it as much as...
I don't know if he was... Here's the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like a lot of this is half-truths, because I think sometimes people do look into it too much, but at mm-hmm. the same time, it did exist, and that he did write all these deceptions and things like that, and so it is central to the plot.
It is, but what he, you know... I think it's just as it's so academic. Like when I was watching it, to me it was just a comedy. It was a comedy for its time that was written for entertainment.
Sure,
not to make a point, you know. Or do you think that?
I don't know. I think it. We don't know.
That's true.
Because
there's not a lot written.
It's tough though because I think there's times when. It seems like he's trying to make a point, but at the same time, he's just trying to keep the audience engaged.
Yeah.
And so, like, he definitely writes to his audiences. He purposefully will write things he knows they are going to enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mistaken identity and deception are things that they enjoy, but at the same time, I think he is able to work within them to give you something deeper.
Mm.
So I think it's a combination, because, you
know...
Part
of his genius, then.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, you know, who can tell? I think in this case, I think what I read is fine because it didn't go into anything crazy like And you can see how he was actually saying that King James was saying this. I'm like, no, you're looking too much into this.
Yeah, that's the dissertations.
Yeah. Like, example, you know, Macbeth, he wrote about the witches and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he wrote a Scottish play because King James was Scottish. And so he was just trying to be like, hey, I wrote you a Scottish play, Scottish King James, mm-hmm. you know. And then he wrote the witches because he knew that King James loved witches. That's the reason he wrote them in.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm. like, there's that.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean he can't make them central to the plot, and it doesn't mean he can't... Like, they're not throwaways.
No, no. I if anything, I think what it is it's along the lines of, like, some of the shows that I think... I know I watch, and I'm sure you watch as well, where they're... The show caters to the common,
sure.
everyday, run-of-the-mill audience, but for those of us who like to look deeper or who we see things that the writers threw in that... maybe 3/4 of their audience will never pick up.
Sure.
Yeah.
It's, you know, there's definitely a, it just depends, because there's a kind of a balance
90%.
Between something just gratuitously put in because you know people are going to want to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, and you watch movies today and it's like gratuitous violence or sex or nudity by itself or, you know, anything. It could be anything.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of times that stuff's put in just because they know people are going to like it and people are going to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, sometimes that stuff can be put in a way where it's well thought out and it's important to what's happening.
Yeah.
And that's fine. It's when it's put in for no other reason than we want to get people to watch this.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Yeah, I agree.
And for the most part, Shakespeare never does that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he definitely puts things in that are fun, but he never does it as a... as a write-off.
Mm-hmm.
It's never like, okay, here's some naked person running through. Like, obviously you couldn't do that back then, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. No, because there is one thing where I know that came up a lot in some of the things I read was whether or not he was sympathetic to the Catholic cause because of the way he writes Catholic characters.
Mm.
And this is right after Catholicism was banned. So there is that idea that...
Well, I don't know. It's just tough because... When you look at Shakespeare's plays, a lot of them, I mean, plays of this time too,
mm-hmm.
a lot of the plays of this time were written in previous time periods. It was not uncommon. Most plays at this time actually, for the most part, weren't written in their contemporary time.
Yeah.
Because that was interesting for people, you know.
But that's what they were saying, is that he was able to utilize that to be able to put forth... positive statements and sentiments about Catholicism that if he would have said in just in everyday parlance and everyday usage would have gotten him thrown in jail.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a very strict time, anti-Catholicism at the time.
Right.
So I mean, that's why I'm like, even here there was an article on how the way the priest was
a
friar, and how he was portrayed and how he even had like. Made him get gave him a little pivotal role
in
the scheme and stuff.
I think a lot of times priests or friars in his stories actually play a role that they would never play in real life.
Mm-hmm.
They often dabble in not magic, but they dabble in other sources, I should say. Like you have, you know, in like in this one, he basically tells them, "Yeah, you should just deceive people. You know,
yeah.
Great, you should pretend she's dead." Where I feel like in reality, like a priest probably would not tell you that. And then in Romeo and Juliet, like you have the priest who is able to...
He orchestrated almost everything.
Well, yeah, he orchestrated. Yeah. But then he also like is dabbling in like horticultural type stuff and where they have like medicinal purposes, which who's to say they couldn't do that in reality? Like, but like I feel like in a lot of his stories, like the priests and the friars are always doing things that they probably wouldn't have done as much in reality, but it helps with the plot.
Well, but he's also writing a play in which it's the character, and he needs a vehicle to advance the story. So, I mean, yeah,
he writes stories that are set in other places. Like he doesn't ever really write a play set in England.
Yeah, the Henry plays and Richard.
Yeah, but those are historical. Those are in previous time periods.
Yeah.
So that one is, those are a little different because those are a different time period. So
you're saying he doesn't write any, okay, no modern.
He doesn't really write any contemporary English plays.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of his plays are set in Italy, actually, or mm-hmm. in mythical places, and places that never really existed or exist only within fantasy or mythology.
Yeah.
But and in regards to what you're saying, I think The fact that he's a friar and he's Catholic is kind of a moot point because, I mean, I don't know why he said it in Italy when he did, but I actually stumbled onto that he said it in Italy in Messina during a time when it was being ruled by the Spanish, which I thought was interesting. And so that's a very specific time period. And so they would have been Catholic anyways. Like, there's no way.
There's no way
they would have been Protestant.
I think the point of like a lot of the writings I've come across is more just that it's an example of him putting a message in there, potentially, I should say, because not everyone agrees, but potentially putting in a message. Because I think this, you know how there's a lot of, were they not? In this case, the question was, was he truly Catholic friendly, or was he not?
Well, and then you never know, like, as we can argue all day long, we'll never know.
Oh yeah, no, that's what it ultimately came down to.
I remember when I was in one of my history of theater classes, we were talking about Shakespeare. We were specifically talking in text analysis about Romeo and Juliet.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my professor, again, I don't remember where he got this. I'm just going to assume he got it from like an actual academic source. But he was talking about how when he was writing Romeo and Juliet, if you look at it in Romeo and Juliet, I know we're not talking about Romeo and Juliet today. We'll probably talk about it another time. But in that one, you never know why these two families are fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know it's an old fight. Like, you know they've been fighting for a long time, for like years and years.
Yeah.
But you never know the reason. You're never given that reason because it's not important.
Mm-hmm.
But you know that it's so prevailing that like blood has been shed over it.
Yeah.
And what my professor was saying is he was writing this during a time in England when there was a great animosity and actual fighting between the Catholics and the Protestants. And so what he was saying, again, I don't know, but he was saying that this is Shakespeare looking at that and basically saying, you know what, you guys just need to stop fighting and you just need to come together and find some sort of commonality.
You know, if that's, and see, that kind of goes back to what we were saying before. I would say if that's true, that would lend to his genius that he was able to do that. To create things like that, because your professor's right. That is the time of, you know, it's right after the I've been listening to a podcast on Napoleon, so and I'm watching something on King Henry, and so just seeing
Napoleon's a little bit later.
Yeah, no, but King Henry VIII, and they were kind of going a little bit. They keep on touching on the Jacobite rebellion,
right,
so I had to look that up and read. I was reading about that, and so yeah, no, it is around that time where there was a lot of stuff going on, but I mean, suffice it to say. Even though I haven't read a lot of him, from what I have seen and read, like I have been amazed by just how he was able to write, what he was able to do, how much he was able to put in there, things that, like you were saying before, like I've read Romeo and Juliet maybe 4 times now, and each time I've learned something new, and I love that about his plays. That's why, honestly, I wouldn't mind rereading this one again down the road.
You know what I think is funny is when I was. Oh, and so I was, sorry, backtracking a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So I was saying that Shakespeare was, he wrote in a way that you could just listen to it and not have to watch it and you would know what's happening.
Yeah.
Because of that, I purposefully decided to listen to an audio version of it this time around. And yeah, it's true. I knew, you have to pay attention, but I knew exactly what was happening. And I thought it was really fun. Like, you actually don't miss anything.
Yeah.
I mean, you get a lot of nuances and characterizations when you watch it, but but it's not like modern plays where you really should watch it. Like, you can just listen to Shakespeare and you understand everything perfectly.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think it goes back to what you were saying earlier, that because of the people who couldn't see it, he wrote it in a way that allows you to visualize it in your head.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But I was laughing because I was... There's definitely times where I listen or I read Shakespeare that, you know, things slip through the cracks. And I try to figure out, you know, wait, what did I miss? Wait, why is this happening? And so I go and I look back, or I'll like pull up, like, I'll Google, you know, what is this? But or I'll go to my books, but if I actually really want to. But I was this time around because there was a lot of people who were complaining about Don John, who's... you know, in the play, they call him, he's the bastard brother of Don Pedro.
Correct.
And a lot of people were complaining that he's a very flat character, that he basically has, like, no reason other than just pettiness and just mischief to do what he's doing.
Yeah.
Because he's the one who's trying to, like, just break everybody up and just mess with them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so people have complained about that. And I basically Googled, because I was also just curious, like, wait, who were they even fighting at the beginning of this? Because they all the soldiers are coming back from a war that they were victorious in. And I was laughing because when I was looking it up, it said that Don Pedro was fighting his brother, Don John, his bastard brother, Don John.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just came to a peaceful conclusion.
Yeah.
But obviously Don John was not so happy about it.
Yeah.
And so I was laughing because I'm like, well, that's your reason. Like, they just fought a war. Of course he's unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
So I get it. I think if you don't know that, though, then sure. But
yeah.
But
they never really spell it out, though, do they?
They don't, but yeah. They do. If you pay attention early on when the soldiers first meet Leonato,
mm-hmm.
Don Pedro introduces Don John to him. And in that moment, you pick up on the fact that they were once against each other and they were rivals, but now they're at peace. And so Leonato welcomes him into his home.
And that's why there's that tension between Leonardo and... Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Now that you explained it, yeah. I mean, I just assumed it was because he knew he was someone who was not welcome
in court. As a bastard son, he had, like, all the shame.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it's not his fault, but in that time period, if you were the bastard child of someone, you were, like, less than the other children.
Mm-hmm.
And you had essentially, like, no prospects.
Yeah.
And...
Unless your parent recognized you.
Sure.
But that was in the English system. I don't know how the Italian system
works. It's very
worked.
Difficult. I think in society, if society knew you were a bastard child, mm-hmm. it was very difficult for you.
Yeah.
Your place in society was, you know, tentative.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing someone was talking about that I found very interesting is Don John in the play, he essentially makes it so that he imposes all that he had to go through on the other characters, which I thought was very interesting. It was like an interesting sort of revenge.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most obviously with Hero, like, he basically frames her for being unchaste, like having essentially slept around with someone.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, in that society, you know, like, that was a horrible deal breaker for a woman. Like, that would, you could bounce back if you were accused. But if you were publicly shamed the way that Hero is in the play,
mm-hmm.
then you're, like, scarred. Like, you there's, like, nothing really for you. And that reflects on your family.
Yeah.
And so
it's, based on the dad's response, right? Yeah, that was evident.
Yeah. And so when you look at it, if in the play, Don John actually is the one who says you should go publicly shame her.
Mm-hmm.
I get the idea that Claudio would have just broken it off, but the fact that Don John says, like, you know what, if you want to marry her, great, but you should go to the wedding tomorrow and then publicly shame her in front of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so that just, like, clinches the deal.
Yeah.
And so that's why people have said that although it seems like a very weird, unnecessary thing to have this fake death
mm-hmm.
for Hero in the play, when you think about it in the context, it makes a lot of sense because for her to have appeared to have died because of these accusations
mm-hmm.
would, like, metaphorically for her society show that she was innocent.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, it gives her family time to prove that she was.
Mm-hmm.
And so just when everybody's feeling sorry for her and they're able to finally, like, prove that she was innocent.
Yeah.
When they reveal that she's actually still alive, like, she's metaphorically come back to life.
Mm-hmm.
It makes a lot of sense for their time period.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I did have a little... Initially, when I read it, I had a hard time understanding that part.
Sure.
You know, I think, like, it's... In our times, it's... Things are so different.
Yeah, and I think the one thing that people always... forget is that because of Benedict's love for Beatrice,
mm-hmm.
he agrees to challenge Claudio to a duel.
Yeah.
But that would have been horribly difficult for him because Claudio was like a brother to him.
Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
I actually liked that part, but it was an interesting.
Yeah. Kind of, I mean, obviously never went anywhere. Mm-hmm. Like, it would have been interesting to see them actually duel, but the fact that they didn't have to is, like, I think if this was a tragedy, they would have dueled.
Yeah.
For sure. I think somebody once said that Much Ado About Nothing is a comedy that almost could have been a tragedy.
Yeah, I can see that. I think I'm curious to see where it falls into the timeline of what he wrote. He had written so many tragedies, maybe he needed a comedy at this part.
I don't remember. I think it was earlier in his career that he wrote this one.
Oh, okay.
But yeah.
No. So what other analysis?
I have a lot. I just don't want to overburden it, you know. No, you know what? I think I covered it all. Yeah. I think I've said everything that I need to for the play. Is there anything else you want to talk about in regards to the play before we talk about the film adaptation?
So there's one. I mean, this is. I don't know if you want to talk about it now or was going to bring it up later, but
okay.
Something I read was an idea that even though it's not a side-by-side adaptation, someone suggested, did Jane Austen borrow from this play for Pride and Prejudice?
There have been a lot of people I came across who said that there are a lot of themes and motifs and elements from mm-hmm. Shakespeare that were used by Jane Austen.
Mm-hmm.
Which would make sense, because he was very popular during her time, and she would have studied him.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Maybe.
Yeah, because there was a whole website dedicated to comparing the two together. I think the person that I was reading, though, at the end felt that there were too many dissimilarities, so she may have just pulled motifs.
I think a lot of it is so... A lot of the elements,
mm-hmm.
not the specifics, are universal enough that you can find them in a lot of stories.
Yeah.
Like, I even myself, I was thinking you could easily adapt Much Ado About... Well, not necessarily easily, but you could adapt Much Ado About Nothing into a modern story. And you would change things, but you could, and you could definitely make it interesting. Like, I could see that happening.
You should write an adaptation.
I'm not going to pretend that I'm not trying to.
That would be cool.
Yeah. But I don't want to give too much away.
Okay.
All right.
On to the movie.
Yeah, because I love this movie. How did you like this movie? Be straight. Your silence concerns me.
It was. You know, I think The Grinch was better. Just kidding.
That's horrible. Just kidding.
I didn't hate it.
You hated the Jim Carrey version.
No, I grew to like it at the end. I just had to separate it as a different film than the book.
Whatever.
So, in the cartoon. No, so honestly, I actually really enjoyed it. Since I haven't watched a Shakespeare movie in a while, it took me a little while to get used to
the
actors. Not the language, but the actors portraying. Like, seeing, like there were times when I felt they were kind of flat. But then I realized...
Looking at you, Keanu Reeves.
No, even Denzel. There were a couple of times I was like, his lines came across flat. But then
sure.
That was like towards the beginning. But after I got over those pieces, I really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I wouldn't mind actually sitting and rewatching it sometime soon.
Okay.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised with how much I liked it.
Okay, nice. So, the... 1993 film adaptation of Much Ado About Nothing was written and directed by Kenneth Branagh, and it has music by Patrick Doyle. It starred Branagh as Benedick, Emma Thompson as Beatrice, Denzel Washington as Don Pedro, Keanu Reeves as Don John, Richard Briers as Leonato, and Michael Keaton as Dogberry, Robert Sean Leonard as Claudio, Imelda Staunton as Margaret, and Kate Beckinsale in her film debut as Hero. May I read excerpts from Roger Ebert's review?
Because I read that one too.
Were you going to talk about it?
No, I was, but I left all my papers in my backpack.
I love that we always find the same stuff.
Yes.
Except for me, because I always go to YouTube and you don't.
Yeah, I spoke to someone about that this morning. I need to watch more YouTube.
Yeah, what did they say? They say you're old?
Pretty much, because they're a millennial too.
Well, I'm not on any social media, so... All right, so this is an excerpt from Roger Ebert's review from The Time. He says, "Sunshine and laughter and merrymakers on a hillside sprinkled with flowers. In the opening scene of Much Ado About Nothing, Kenneth Branagh insists on the tone the movie will take. These are healthy, joyful, young people whose high spirits will survive anything, even the dark double crosses of Shakespeare's plot. A play like Much Ado About Nothing is all about style. I doubt if Shakespeare's audiences at the Globe took it any more seriously than we do. It is farce and mime and wisecracks and dastardly melodrama, which all comes right in the end, of course, because this is a comedy. The key to the film's success is in the acting, especially in the sparks that fly between Branagh and Thompson, as their characters aim their insults so lovingly that we realize sooner than they do how much they would miss their verbal duets.
Mm-hmm.
Any modern film of Shakespeare must deal with the fact that many people in the audience will be unfamiliar with the play, and perhaps even with the playwright. Branagh deals with this fact by making Much Ado into a film that reinvents the story. This is not a film of a Shakespeare play, but a film that begins with the same materials and the wonderful language and finds its own reality. It is cheerful from beginning to end, since we can hardly take the moments of doom and despair seriously. It is entirely appropriate that it has been released in the springtime. Yeah. It makes me want to watch it again. Okay. Now we can talk.
Yes.
Go ahead.
It was good.
Great.
That's my analysis.
Well, thanks for listening to our podcast.
No, I think from the starting with the actors and off the bat, I'll call him KB. KB.
Please don't.
And what's her name?
Emma Thompson.
Emma Thompson's character.
Yes.
They
were married in real life at this time.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay. I loved the scenes between them, or even when they, heck, just even when they were, when Don Pedro was trying to, and the other guys were trying to, and then the women were doing the same thing to her character, Beatrice, trying to get them to fall, to start thinking about the other person. I honestly love those, their interactions together, and anytime they were on screen. Now, the other characters were great, but I think for me, the wit, yes, and with Shakespeare's words in their mouths, I love those scenes.
I mean, definitely of the two lovers in the story,
mm-hmm.
even though they have a lot less stage time,
yeah.
they are the more compelling.
Yes, yeah.
And I think people have argued that they are the better couple.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Hero and Claudio have more of a love at first sight aspect.
It's the young love.
Yes.
Yeah. We've seen it before. We kind of know where it's heading.
Right.
But yeah.
Although I will say in Kenneth Branagh's version, he leans more into the fact that they have had a little bit of a relationship
mm-hmm.
before going to war. Which helps.
Okay.
I think he leans more into that
yeah.
than the original play does. And then there's the idea, it's not obvious, but you can pick up on it if you choose to. It's never outright said, but there's the idea that Benedict and Beatrice have had a relationship in the past.
I kind of picked up on that too. The other thing I think that Roger Ebert mentioned that I agree with him on is the opening. I thought the opening set the scene and the tone, even mm-hmm. though it was really different than yeah. the rest of the play.
Yes.
For me, I loved that scene setting, the mm-hmm. era setting, and also the liveliness and them getting ready and
yeah,
all that.
It reassures the audience that no matter what happens, that this is a happy film.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody was saying that came across the same thing that was like a dissertation,
yeah.
basically. And I did not finish. But it was talking about how one of the things that Kenneth Branagh brought to this film
mm-hmm.
is the motif of water that is not really found in the original script. And you can see it most obviously in the... Again, I don't know if this is just people looking way too much into things.
Mm-hmm.
But in the beginning, when the characters are all going to meet each other for the first time, all the soldiers are coming to Messina... all the women rush off to go bathe themselves and prepare themselves for the soldiers and look their best. And then mm-hmm. all the soldiers, when they get there, they also have like a communal bath and they're getting ready to meet the women.
Yeah.
And so they're both equally preparing for each other.
Yeah.
And putting on their best faces. But they're both like, they're all so joyful because like one is happy that everyone's coming back from the war and the others are happy that the war is over and they can come home.
Mm-hmm.
And... Yeah, I mean, that's like the one time where people are happy about a war.
Yeah.
The end. That's obviously not in the script. The whole bathing them and stuff.
No, but I think it was the scenes. It was the mood setting.
Well, it's just, there's no way you can watch that scene and not be happy.
Yeah.
And I love the overture to that whole movie.
Mm.
I always felt like that overture would be perfect to graduate to.
I'll have to listen to it again. I can kind of remember it.
I love Patrick Doyle's work. He's so good. But,
I thought you were looking it up.
No, what? No, I'm not going to play it.
It's probably copyrighted.
No, probably. I was just going to say, I'm reading this from Cliff Notes again. In Kenneth Branagh's 1993 film, Much Ado About Nothing, it's an outstanding adaptation of the play that benefits from his, what they said, judicious cutting and rearrangement of the text, as well as from his casting. He has filmed on location in and around an actual sunny Italian villa of appropriate age and condition. The villa, I'm not even going to try to pronounce it. Nah, why not? Vina Maggio in Tuscany. The setting contributes greatly to qualities of timelessness and isolation from the rest of the world, as well to its visual impact, which I agree with. I think the film is definitely supposed to be set in a specific time period, and my guess is it's like the late 1600s, but I don't know.
Okay.
I'm just guessing from the costumes.
Yeah.
But, and also because he mentions when Spain was ruling Italy, or that Sicily, but it definitely feels timeless, like mm-hmm. the way he portrays them. Like, it's definitely like a period piece, but it fits. Like, I feel like it's so set apart from its culture and its time, you know?
No, I agree. Yeah. I agree.
I think the one thing people always talk about is the pacing that for his film is so good. Like, he quickens the pace and he makes it, he picks up the slack and he eliminates some things that makes the scenes go by faster than they would have. And he also rearranges a few things. I was laughing because somebody once said, I came across them writing and they said that despite all the cuts that Kenneth Branagh made, he did not eliminate any of the monologues his character has to speak.
That's KB.
Stop.
No, that's one of the things I did pick when I read it the second time, because I didn't pick it up the first time I watched it. But when I read it afterwards, I noticed that the dialogue was different. Same words and stuff.
I would say like 85% of it is exactly the way that it was in the script.
Yeah, most of it was.
And then the rest of it is either eliminated or just rearranged.
Yeah. But, I mean, yeah, it's done.
It's remarkably faithful.
Mm-hmm.
I think his main thing that I really appreciate is, and I think this is Shakespeare done right, I think, for modern audiences. I feel like a lot of times, like with Jane Austen or Shakespeare or other, you know, older writers, when people try to write an adaptation for a modern audience, they just get carried away. And they're like, oh, we got to make these characters like super modern and have, and like kind of like in Keira Knightley's version of Pride mm-hmm. and Prejudice.
Yeah.
How like they changed Elizabeth completely.
Yeah.
And she definitely felt like a modern character. Like, he doesn't do that. Kenneth Branagh doesn't do that with these characters.
No, that is a flaw with contemporary adaptations, because I read about an adaptation, or I want to say it was the Royal Shakespeare Company. They did this Much Ado About Nothing.
Was that the one with David Tennant and, oh, what's her name?
No, it wasn't. I didn't recognize any of the actors. This was probably from the early 2000s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But what they did do is they rewrote it so, in this case, Hero is not a virgin.
Okay.
Yeah, because they felt that modern audiences wouldn't understand the sensibility. You know, our sensibilities are different. And
see, I don't like it when those drastic changes are made.
Yeah, no, and the article I was reading was criticizing some of the changes they made to... They didn't change necessarily all the language, like the language, but they made some changes like that to empower the women.
Yeah, we see what Kenneth Branagh did is... he was creating a Shakespeare adaptation that a person who has never been exposed to Shakespeare could watch and enjoy.
Yeah.
Which I think he succeeded in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's critically acclaimed. I think, you know, it people, you know, can get nitpicky and they have things they don't like, but, and I mean, I'm sure you get people who are like Shakespeare purists who are like, how'd you cut anything from the Bard? You know?
Yeah.
But here's the thing. One of the things that I came across that I agree with is, besides the amazing casting, like he always has amazing cast in his films. Like I would just say watch one of his movies just for the people in it, you know? Mm-hmm. But it definitely draws them in. And obviously we said the pacing is great. His pacing is amazing. He can be melodramatic. I have watched a lot of his movies, and I do love his movies.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it is detrimental to his films.
Okay.
He did a version of Mozart's The Magic Flute that is not great.
Mm.
it was just way too over the top.
Okay.
But in this one, there's a couple moments where I was like, a little much, but it fits the tone, you know, the tone. Like they're serious when they need to be serious, and they're over the top when they need to be over the top, you know. And it was never inappropriate in that aspect.
True.
But he eliminates lines, like I said, that didn't need to be included in a film where the visuals are the main medium.
Okay.
Because like we said, in the play, he wrote it so you could just listen to it, and so things would be said so you understood. In the film adaptation, he eliminates, the main things that he eliminates are bits of lines that tell the audience things. Instead of telling the audience, he films it so that you can see it and not hear it.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't really pay attention to what lines were eliminated.
Well, I mean, and to be fair, some of this I'm picking up from a website that was talking about it, but
okay.
I was also watching it and I got some of it. But one of the things I also like is in his film adaptation, one of the things that he does that I think works really well is in the original script, there's a lot of times where the characters will reference other characters when they're not there. But in this one, he'll have the characters walk by or see each other, make eye contact or something.
Okay.
And then that'll be the catalyst for the character to talk about them.
Hmm.
Like, for example, Claudio talks to Benedict about getting married and how he loves Hero. Right after he sees Hero walking up on the balcony, and they have this moment where they look at each other and you can tell they're in love.
Yeah.
And then later on, there's a scene where Don John is walking down the hallway and he passes by Beatrice, I think Ursula, and Hero, and he grabs Hero's hand and he kisses it.
Mm-hmm.
Which seems like a very like chivalrous thing to do, except that you as an audience member know he's planning to disrupt everything. And so it's, someone said it's like the kiss of death, which I think is interesting.
Yeah.
But then that is what makes Beatrice comment on Don John.
Mm-hmm.
And so it works very well because it had a, there was a reason for it. Like it didn't just come out of nowhere.
That makes sense. The other thing that I picked up on it was how many Harry Potter characters were in there. Or actors.
Oh, there's... That's just because Harry Potter, like, pulled, like, all the most famous British actors.
Yeah, there's... I think there's only three, if I remember right. But still, it was funny seeing them all there together. But it makes you...
Why is Professor Trelawney and Gilderoy Lockhart kissing?
I know. But at the same time, it was like, when you brought up the whole how he's can be over the top sometimes, that's... I think it was funny how they chose him for that character... Gilderoy Lockhart was over the top. I mean, it fit perfectly.
Yeah,
especially when you know some of his past work.
Right.
But seeing them younger too was also very
sure. I mean, Kate Beckinsale was like 18.
I did not know who that was at first.
Really?
Yeah, when I first I had a look at, I was looking up the actors. In fact, I watched it with. My fiance, and neither one of us recognized her off the bat. So I looked it up, and when I said who it was, we were like, wow, she did, for some reason, she didn't look like Kate Beckinsale to us.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, she looks a little different now than she used to, for sure.
Yeah.
She's still beautiful, but yes. I think what's funny is Michael Keaton plays Dogberry.
Yes.
And I think one of the first things I remember about watching this movie for the first time is my dad saying, Michael Keaton's in this. He's the one that played Beetlejuice, and he basically plays Beetlejuice in this movie.
I didn't. You know, in my mind, I was thinking of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, okay.
And his character.
A lot of people have said that Michael Keaton really seems to be emulating Beetlejuice in this movie.
Mm.
A lot of critics and people have said that basically it's like a watered down Beetlejuice, or like a the cousin to Beetlejuice.
I have to go watch that movie again. It's been a long time.
Like, it's definitely not Beetlejuice, but like the voicing and stuff.
No, yeah, but just the character, facial and...
Yeah.
Because it was the facial expressions and all of that.
And they definitely have that Monty Python, like, we're pretending to ride on horses that aren't there and things like that. You know what's funny is I watched a lot of interviews from the cast for this film.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing I pick up on for this film that I thought was really interesting is how much everyone a part of this movie loved being a part of this movie.
Really?
That's cool. All of them. Everybody. And one of the things that was interesting is they were all talking about how they all essentially lived there during the filming.
Mm-hmm.
And so they all got along so well. And it wasn't like, well, we're going to go back to our hotel rooms now. It was like, no, we're going to stay here and we're going to hang out, you know?
That's cool.
And so they had a big camaraderie. And I think that really shows on the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember, like, Kate Beckinsale was talking about how, like, Emma Thompson essentially, like, took her under her wing and... She was basically saying, like, one of the things that was funny is because they were all living there and they were definitely kind of isolated from a lot of places, that Emma Thompson basically told her, like, she was worried about, like, shaving her armpits and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Emma Thompson's like, who cares? Like, they didn't shave their armpits back then. No one's going to see it anyways. So there was a lot of stuff like that. But, like, literally everybody that interviewed was talking about how much they enjoyed it. And...
So where was Keanu in all this? Brooding in the corner?
I mean, even he enjoyed it, but I think it was funny because Keanu Reeves and Denzel Washington and Michael Keaton were the three especially who said that they were not sure about doing this film at first.
Okay.
But, I mean, Denzel Washington really wanted to do it.
Yeah.
But I remember him saying that it wasn't something that people thought that he would do.
Mm-hmm.
But the three of them for sure all wanted to do it for the challenge.
Okay.
Like, they wanted to do it for the challenge, but they also wanted to do it because of Kenneth Branagh.
Mm, okay.
Like, they knew he was doing it and they said, I want to be in it because of him.
Yeah.
The one thing I don't like is generally Keanu Reeves is just... I'm not a fan of Keanu Reeves.
Okay, yeah.
So to be fair, there's that. I'm just not a fan of him.
Mm-hmm.
I like him as a person. His acting is generally fine, but I don't get the hype, you know?
No, I can see that.
And so there's moments I think he's fine in this. Like, he does a decent job, but for most of the movie, I'm kind of like, can you, like, pick it up a little bit?
You know, to be honest with you, I felt he was the...
A little flat.
Yes, the weakest link in the movie.
Sure.
So I agree with that.
I liked it when... And to be fair, I think if I'm giving him credit where it's due, he does a great job of acting in a way where it seems like he's holding back.
Okay.
And I think that's kind of what Don John is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you see these moments where he is a little explosive in his emotions or whatever, like, he definitely leans into it more, and I like that. But yeah, I think he's definitely probably the weakest chain in the link.
No, I agree.
Wait, link in the chain, that's what it is.
I think the one that surprised me the most was Michael Keaton. Like, I mean I knew the character was in there, but when he popped up, just the way he portrayed it and everything else, it just, I mean, it was Michael Keaton, and so that threw me back for a minute, but I love the character.
Well, it's funny because he actually in an interview said that he was surprised that he was offered the role,
mm-hmm.
because he knew that in a lot of ways this was kind of like a classical piece, and so if you're leaning into that classicism, the character of Dogberry would be played in his mind by, like, a more, like, portly gentleman, like an older portly man.
I can see that as a like a constable.
Yeah,
the way they're kind of portrayed in,
like,
some of the
other, like,
movies.
The idiot.
Yeah,
like the town idiot, essentially. Mm-hmm. But he is the constable. He's the hardest to understand.
Yeah,
because Shakespeare purposely wrote him to actually mess up everything he says.
Oh, I didn't know that.
No?
Yeah.
No, he literally will say things, and he thinks he's saying them sincerely, but he's saying them incorrectly.
Huh. That's interesting.
Yeah, go back and watch it.
Okay,
I will. So he's difficult to understand because you need to realize what he's saying is incorrect.
Oh, okay.
And so, like, in those moments, and that's also part of the reason why if he was more coherent, mm-hmm. Leonardo would have listened to him, and then the whole bit with Claudio accusing Hero would not have happened.
Mm.
Because he already had Baraccio and Conrad.
Mm-hmm.
And so if he was coherent and intelligent and whatever, then Leonardo would have heard him on the day of the wedding, and they would have gone and told Claudio and confronted Don John, and there would have been no plot after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But because Dogberry is essentially an idiot and Leonardo does not take him seriously,
mm-hmm.
that is why it's almost, in a way, that's why I say this could be a tragedy. Because if this was a tragedy and, like, let's say Hero did die,
yeah.
then that would have been we could have prevented this moment.
Mm, yeah.
But no, he's funny. Dogberry is funny. But he did say he wasn't sure at first how to play Dogberry because he didn't think he was the right, like, mold for the character. And so a lot of the choices he made stemmed from that.
Mm.
Like playing him as, like, this kind of gross, I mean, I guess similar to Beetlejuice, I mm-hmm. guess.
Yeah.
But definitely more grabby and, I don't know.
No, as you're saying it, I'm kind of thinking back. Yeah, I can see it now as I'm thinking
He
back.
Made choices.
Mm-hmm. That he did. And it was, honestly, I think in the end, they were good choices. I thought it was a
I don't know what else he would have done.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he could have portrayed it more. Not serious, but
he definitely,
like,
steals the scenes.
Yes, that he does. Yeah,
he commits to what he does.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, there's a way to play an idiot where you're not really committing to it,
mm-hmm.
but he commits.
Yeah. I think if it would have been just a guest star in someone's movie and was doing it more for the paycheck or for the notoriety. But no, he definitely put his acting into it.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
It's a contrast. I mean, honestly, I see him as a contrast to our buddy Keanu.
they compensated for each other.
Yes, they definitely did. Yeah. Sorry to all the Keanu fans out there. I mean, I've enjoyed the stuff he's been in, most of them that
he's
I've seen.
He's great in Speed.
Yes, he is. And I've enjoyed the John Wick movies.
So your favorite movie was Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
You know, okay, I'm going to say something.
Oh.
I've never watched it.
I'm not surprised.
I've seen scenes from it, and, you know, some of the more popular scenes, but I've never sat and watched it.
Nothing you say will shock me anymore.
I know, that's what people say when it comes to me watching movies.
Yeah.
Or hearing songs, apparently, from this weekend's conversation at dinner.
Mm.
There's a lot of music, contemporary music, that I haven't listened to.
Yeah, well, what are you going to do?
my opinion was it all sounds the same, so I like things that are different and older. Sometimes. But that's another conversation for another time. So what else? Do you have anything else for the movie?
I just love his visuals.
Mm.
His scenes are just gorgeous, and he does these amazing tracking shots, and he has a lot of action happening all the time.
I've actually never seen another one of his movies.
Really?
Not yet. I know where they'll probably down the road.
You know, what's funny is you might have and not have known it.
Really?
Yeah. You know, he did the live action version of Cinderella.
I have seen that.
He did that.
Wow. Okay, so I haven't seen a lot of movies where he's
That's in. Definitely the best live action version Disney's done.
I have to agree. That's
And it's the one that they probably want to sweep under the carpet the most.
Which is, I get why it's different. It's doesn't fit the mold that they've done since then.
Well, no, they've gone super woke since then.
Yeah, there's that too. But it was amazing. It was a really good movie. I'm really glad.
No, it's amazing.
It is. But one of the things because you've talked about some of them where
we'll
he's not.
We'll talk about that one.
Yes, we will. You've mentioned how some of his other movies are not as good.
Most of them are.
Most of them are. Okay. In watching Romeo and Juliet.
Which version?
The 1963
got
version?
Sexy version.
I got a little. Sometimes it was good, but the pacing, slow. I got a little slow. Yes.
Well, because it's like verbatim. It's exactly what the script says.
Okay. That's the one thing I noticed in this one. Like you were just saying, his pacing, I never got bored.
Mm-mm, no.
It was boom, 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 boom.
The only time I got a little bored, not mm-hmm. now, but when I used to watch it when I was younger, is when you first have, when you have Don John's first monologue.
Oh, okay.
When he's getting the massage in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
When now I'm not bored, but when I was younger, that was like the only time I got bored.
Okay.
Because nothing's happening.
Yeah.
And because he's so stoic.
Yeah, that he was.
But I mean, out of all the characters in it, he's probably the most simple.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say simple because he has a lot going on, and you can dive into his psychology.
Yeah, he's not a cardboard villain, but he's still just the villain.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, but I can see where you're saying coming with that. I don't know how much of it was him, because now that you mention it, I don't remember, like when I was reading it, I see Keanu reading Don John's lines. And so I don't remember what I thought about it the first time I was reading it.
I imagined him with a little bit more emotion.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll have to reread it.
I think it was just a choice. I think it was... I think what they were trying to go for was this idea of him holding back.
Mm.
Like, not letting people know. I think I mean, to be fair, I think it leans into the theme of deception.
Yeah.
Of not letting people know what you're actually thinking.
Mm, okay. This just popped into my mind. Would you... If you were given an opportunity to be in a production of this...
Oh, I would do it, yeah.
What character?
Who would I want to play?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I mean, for the fun of it, I would love to play Dogberry.
Okay.
Because I think it would just be fun. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, my go-to answer would be I would love to play Benedict.
Yeah.
I think he would just be an amazing character to play. I think even playing Claudio would be fun because mm-hmm. he's got a good range.
Okay.
He's kind of an idiot.
Yeah, that is.
He's deceived very quickly and then never learned that Don John was putting him on for the second time.
Yeah.
I will say that one of the biggest changes is in the script, in the original script, you never actually see that Baraccio is wooing Margaret,
mm-hmm.
Who they think is Hero.
Yeah.
That happens off stage.
Mm-hmm.
But in Kenneth Branagh's version, you actually see it. So that was added in.
Okay.
The whole bit where he was, like, clearly, like, having it on with her.
Yeah.
In the play, it's, like, more suggested, but that they were courting each other.
Mm-hmm.
but, yeah, I think it's a stronger impact to see that happen.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I forgot about those changes.
Yeah. But then Kenneth Branagh makes sure that you see for sure that she's actually sleeping.
Mm, okay.
Yeah.
I do need to go back and rewatch the movie.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, it's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
It's free on Amazon Prime right now.
I think that's where we watched it, in fact. Yeah. Yeah.
No, it's good. I love it. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot of small things like that. You know, obviously we talked about he had edited it.
Mm-hmm.
And he removed some things and rearranged a few things. But, you know, other than the new opening and then that bit where you see Baraccio with Margaret... he didn't really add much.
No.
Like, there's a couple of, you know, he gives them new action to do, and then, like, you see them interacting with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a scene where you see them at dinner, but, you know, that's nothing crazy. But
true. Yeah.
And then there's the really abrupt lightning storm. You don't remember? It like, changed the tension.
Because it automatically
goes to Don John.
You're right. Okay.
Yeah.
I had to.
Yeah, that was a directing choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I just love the music is my favorite part of this movie. The soundtrack is amazing. I mean, I've already said I love Patrick Doyle's work, and
mm-hmm.
and Kenneth Branagh uses him for almost every movie. He's basically the Danny Elfman to Kenneth Branagh's Tim Burton.
So I'm looking it up on Spotify.
Oh, it's so good.
I'll have to listen to it.
And it's actually a very simple melody. Like, he doesn't... He uses one general motif for all the soundtrack, mainly.
Okay.
But the way that he changes it and is amazing. And it's so impactful.
Yeah.
It's like the scene where Benedict and Beatrice... are deceived and are tricked into loving each other, but then actually fall in love with each other. Like
mm-hmm.
that.
I love that.
It's so good.
I know. I think that would be, yeah, I agree. Those two characters, either Dogberry or Benedict, would be fun to play.
Right. I mean, I think Claudia would still be fun just because, you know, he has to go through the whole range of emotions.
Yeah, but I feel like I'm a little too old for that role.
It's called acting, Romy. Acting.
I'd need makeup. cover up my wrinkles.
You don't even have wrinkles.
True, I don't, but...
I have more wrinkles than you.
So, no, overall, I'm glad we chose this as our first Shakespeare movie and play to go through.
It was fun.
Yeah, I know we had originally talked about Romeo and Juliet sometime back, but I'm glad we did this one first.
My favorite scene in this one, in this film is the wedding scene.
Because of all the chaos and all the stuff going on?
Well, it's a beautiful scene,
yeah,
and it's so dramatic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, he definitely leans into the drama. Like, how many times are you going to flip over furniture?
That's true.
But it's just well done, you know, the opening of the doors and them coming out, and then just, like, the slow drama of, like, do you take this woman? No, and all that, you know, yeah, it's good.
What about the way the dad reacted to it all?
What about it?
Because, I read in one place, I found out after, it was a feminist essay.
Sure.
In regards to, you know, the misogyny and the overreacting and the way he treated the daughter. Because, I mean, he was practically about to beat her.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah. And, but...
Well, I mean, he even, like, hints at killing her.
Yeah. And...
Yeah.
And I was reading that in the stage directions, it's not really... There's the language, but there's no actual direction given as to how he reacted.
And sure.
Different actors have handled it differently.
Yeah. No, I think it's tough because... You know, from a modern perspective, for sure, you know, I would want him to still be loving and caring for Hiro, even if she had, you know, slept with someone prior to the wedding. You know, I would still want him to be supportive of her, but, you know, he could be disappointed, but he could,
Do you think they portrayed it well in this version?
You know, because the movie, it leans into the melodrama, and so I think it's fine.
Okay.
Because the whole point for a Shakespeare comedy is it's a little over the top.
Okay.
And so I think for what it's meant to be, I think it's fine.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't stay there long anyways. It's more of like...
They hold him back.
Yeah. Well, and if you look at a lot of the characters, especially in this one, a lot of the... excluding Claudio, almost all of the soldiers are very stoic. Which fits with the idea of what a soldier is.
Yeah.
You know, like, they can party and they can have fun, but they're kind of maintained and under control. Mm-hmm. Except for Claudio, who's young and in love and impetuous. But then, you know, a lot of the other characters who live in Messina are very by the spur of the moment, and they live by every emotion. And so, you know, it makes sense in the context.
It does, because I read in another place, it might have been Spark Notes, in fact.
Maybe.
Where they talked about honor and dignity.
Yes, yes. Well, and because we did talk about how her shame would reflect on the family.
Yes.
So,
and even though that's not how we would react to things today, I know for me, honor and dignity is something, it's something I find very important. And, right. And,
well, and I think... the danger that we have today with a lot of people is wanting to constantly change these things so that it better conforms to a modern sentimentality.
Yeah.
When I think you should be able to look at it from what it was and you can see what was happening and why and address it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, just because you're seeing something happening doesn't mean you have to replicate it.
True. No, I think you're spot on that. It's in regards to just looking at the underlying lesson, I guess you could say, overall, that it's trying to get across. And this is why I love doing these podcasts with you, is being able to look at of course contemporary stuff, but also older stuff.
I like to dive in a little deeper, and I think you and I come to the table with different things, and I think it helps a lot. But also remember, I think if Claudio had just gone to Hiro, or even just to Leonato, and broken off the marriage, I don't think they would have been that dramatic. It would not have been that over the top.
Yeah.
Like, there still would have been some high emotions and stuff, but it wouldn't have been anything like that. But the fact that Claudio so publicly shamed her in front of everyone and then left.
Yeah.
Like, I think that is what tipped it over.
And that's why she had to die.
Metaphorically, right? Mm-hmm. Like they,
because they had to go over the top in order. They had to go one step above him in order to write it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think at first, like I said, it's a little weird to think about it,
mm.
but then I think it's handled very well in Branagh's version.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen stage productions of this where it's kind of awkward, where it's like, oh, we're at a funeral now. Oh, okay. Oh, this is weird. Okay. But in Branagh's version, I think in part because of the music, but...
You know, the processional and all
yes,
that.
Yes, but see they like ease into it.
Mm-hmm.
Like they slowly build to the funeral scene.
Yeah.
Where he puts the epitaph on her crypt.
Crypt.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Like you're building to it, yeah. And then you see the procession, but then it pulls back, and you see Hero is with her uncle.
Yeah,
and I like that because it shows that like there's this constant idea of we are working behind the scenes,
mm-hmm.
and you see that in his version,
okay.
which I like. So I just think, I think again, you know, like they lead up to it very well, and then they pull back from it very well.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would have been awkward to pull back from a scene like that and then jump back into happiness,
mm-hmm.
but they do it so smoothly with his characters, like with Dogberry and other people, you know.
I love the movie despite my pause at the beginning when you first asked me.
All right, so like what would you give it a rating then out of 10? 10 the best.
I mean, I think for me the hard part is not having anything to compare it against.
Okay.
Like other movies of his or other Shakespeare movies outside of Romeo and Juliet, which I vaguely remember the 63 version.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a rating then.
Okay, go ahead.
Do you know or do you need time?
I need time.
Okay. I think I'm going to give it an 8.
Okay.
Just because there's like, you know, what we mentioned already, like Keanu Reeves' characterization and... Mm-hmm. There's a few moments that are a little bit maybe too over the top and what have you. But I'll still give it an 8 because I think it's still a movie that I would watch regularly.
Yeah.
And I always enjoy watching it and I always walk away happy.
Yeah.
Which I guess is the point.
Mm-hmm.
He definitely leaned into the sexiness.
Mm, yeah. No, it's funny you give it an 8 because I think I was leaning towards a 7.5 just because I was of what I had said before. I don't know. I don't want to give it that high, but I didn't want to go lower either. And I was vacillating between a 7 and an 8. So I just split the difference.
Vacillating. Got it. Good word.
Yes. So split the difference and give it a 7.5.
Okay. Okay.
Just, but I think if we were to come back to this after we do a couple more Shakespeare or a couple more Kenneth Branagh movies, I might change my mind. So, or maybe even after I watch it one more time, I'm definitely going to go back and watch it. For those who've never actually watched outside of Romeo and Juliet or anything you've done in high school and are maybe hesitant to watch a movie about with Shakespearean language, not necessarily something that's been translated into the modern. I would say throw that caution away and watch, especially this one.
The actors do such a good job of conveying everything that even if you're not paying it, if you don't pick up on everything, you know exactly what's happening.
Yes, and I think it's a good entry movie.
Yes,
for those who have never watched Shakespeare or who had bad experiences in high school, his job on this one is just so amazing. Any apprehension or you may have about the language in that part, don't worry about it, you know. But I just wanted to throw that out.
I think you could watch this. I love Shakespeare's language. I love his writing.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like in Kenneth Branagh's version, you could almost watch it without any dialogue and still know what's happening.
Yeah, I did. I mean, I felt
you'd miss out on stuff, but you would still know what's happening.
Yeah. No, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. Yeah, I would say don't let your apprehension about the old English, Shakespearean Elizabethan. Yeah,
I think
English?
They said it's like early modern English.
Yeah, you shouldn't let that dissuade you from enjoying something that will bring a little culture and
I will say I think out of all his scripts, this is probably the most approachable.
Mm, yeah,
okay. He's definitely written other scripts where he dives into like different mythological figures where like you have to understand them or or he'll write in, yeah.
Well, out of curiosity, what other ones has he done besides, like, Henry?
What he's written, like, over 30 plays.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'll have to look up his biography then.
He's written a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. That's why when you go to Barnes & Noble and you buy a complete works of Shakespeare, it's like buying a dictionary.
Yeah.
Or a Bible.
Oh, wait. Who are you talking about?
Shakespeare.
Oh, no. I meant Kenneth Branagh.
Oh. I said... Oh, whatever.
That's always like, plays. Wow, I didn't know he wrote plays, too.
No, he's done a lot, too. Kenneth Branagh's done a lot.
No, but I meant, like, how many movies has he done?
He's done a lot.
But Shakespeare movies, I'm talking.
Oh, he's done at least three.
Okay.
At least three.
Okay.
I know he did Henry V, he did this one, and then he did Hamlet.
Okay.
I love his Hamlet, but it is not nearly as approachable as this one.
Mm. Yeah, because you were talking about needing to know mythological figures, so that's what I was wondering.
Sometimes, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. Real quick. So, who was your favorite character? You could say the book or the movie.
Yeah, it would be the same for both.
Okay.
That's a hard one. Beatrice.
Okay. Why?
Especially for a female character, I loved her wit.
Mm-hmm.
And the back and forth with Benedict. But mm-hmm. her wit, especially when he wasn't on stage with her or on screen. Yeah.
And I like her because she has a lot of depth to her character.
Yes.
Like, she'll say things, but then later on she'll say something else that's almost the opposite. And you can pick up on, like, how lonely she can be and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. And then Emma Thompson's portrayal.
And she's just a gorgeous woman, too.
It was amazingly done.
I love Emma Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
She's great.
How about you?
You know, I've always said Beatrice.
Yeah.
For similar reasons. And she's just a great character. I think every actress I know who likes Shakespeare,
mm-hmm.
Every actress I've met has said they would love to play her.
Mm.
I think... Man, this is tough. I definitely still think it's Beatrice.
Okay.
But my heart has a very sweet spot for Hero in the film version.
Okay.
Because she's just so sweet and sincere and endearing and loving.
Mm-hmm.
And Kate Beckinsale just did an amazing job for her first film.
Oh, this was her first film?
It was her film debut.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think she had done theater and stuff, but this was her first film.
Okay.
Yeah. So she did a great job.
Yeah.
And just something about her character that draws you in. Like, you see, like, the way that she looks at Claudio, or the way that she loves her father or Beatrice or her uncle, or even the way that she'll interact with other characters like Ursula or Benedict.
Yeah.
Or anyone. Like, she... I don't know. She's just like, she's someone that I would love to have around.
Okay.
But definitely Beatrice. I love Beatrice. She's definitely the most compelling female character. Whereas I would say that Benedict's the most compelling male character.
Yeah. No, I agree.
Yeah. All right. Any other tidbits or anything before we move on?
Nope. That's all I have.
All right. So now is the time for, I guess, our favorite section called What Type of Adaptation Is This? And for anybody new to the podcast, please go listen to our trailer where we talk about the four type of adaptations are that I came up with. And real quick, though, there's four types. One is faithful to source material. The second is expanded. The third is artistic. And the last one is message driven. And what do you think Kenneth Branagh's version is?
Faithful to source material.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah?
I mean, there might be... there's artistic as well, a little bit of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's what's difficult, because I think you could always... Anytime you're adapting to a different medium,
yeah,
it is always going to be a little artistic.
That's... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Artistic is choices were made to emphasize the themes, the plots, the characters through metaphor, symbolism, etc. Sometimes exaggerated fantastical elements.
Yeah.
And so I think it's not quite artistic enough to meet that criteria.
No, you're right. So I think, yeah, definitely faithful to source material.
Because faithful to source material, it attempts to remain as accurate as possible with, you know, historically with the dialogue and the themes and the characters and stuff. And besides the fact that, you know, he eliminated a few lines and rearranged a few things, it is remarkably faithful.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That one's easy.
Yeah. No, I loved this one. This is a good one.
Mm-hmm. No, like I said, I'm glad we did it. I'm glad we read
it. Good. I'm glad that you enjoyed it.
We read this one and watched that movie.
Final thoughts.
It was good.
Great.
I'm a man of few words. Honestly, I'm kind of hungry. I'm just looking forward to dinner. I haven't eaten all day.
I'm hungry too. Let's go get food.
All right.
All right. Thank you again.
Thank you all.
And take care.
All right. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, Willing to Adapt.
Please like and subscribe. Maybe leave a review or just share us with friends and family.
We would also love if you would follow us on social media.
If you have ideas for future episodes for us, please email us at ericandromi@willingtoadapt.com.
That's Romy with an I.
And remember, when the only thing constant in life is change, be willing to adapt.